Hi, Blogging Heads viewers. It is Daniel Strauss of Woodruff & Strauss and TPM, and we are back. No more guest bloggers, although we'd like to thank Rebecca and Jim, who at the end bizarrely talked about how they were going to take over the show. Settle down, everyone.
Yeah, dream big, guys.
aim for the king, you best not miss. Today, I have with me not Slate's Betsy Woodruff, but the Daily Beast's Betsy Woodruff, who's the same person. But, you know, congratulations on the new job, Betsy. Yeah.
Thank you.
I like the background. I like Reagan on one side, Truman on the other.
Thank you. Yeah, I was thinking with this new setup that sort of I can, if I'm trying to do any sort of partisan dog whistling, I can sort of go in Republican mode, go in Democrat mode. You can try to do like a balancing thing where you have both of them. I don't know. It's a lot of good
options.
It's kind
of a tell right now which way you'll be leaning during the episode.
A lot of good options. Yeah, it's good. So I just need to sneak some like triangle or Illuminati signals in, and then we're good. We're good to go.
And you have two presidents who are revered. I mean, Reagan more so by Republicans and Truman by the Democrats behind you. And what a coincidence, because we are neck deep in 2016 campaign season.
What a coincidence. How fortuitous.
Who saw that coming? And just this weekend, it finally happened.
It's happening.
Finally. Hillary Clinton announced that she's running for president, which is the least surprising bit of news that every editor in every newsroom and every reporter was waiting, like, frantically for. Did you watch the rollout? What did you think of it?
In fact, so I'm glad you asked. I am not on the Hillary Clinton beat. Every night before I go to bed, I say a prayer and I thank the Lord for my family and for my friends and for my warm house and for the fact that I do not have to cover Hillary Clinton this election cycle, because that would be literally the worst thing ever.
We have very talented reporters
at Daily Beast covering Hillary Clinton. We have her covered. David Friedlander is going to be doing a lot. He's really good. He's good at it. And I don't have to write about her. It's awesome. It's amazing. So during the Hillary Clinton rollout, which was on Sunday, I did a lot of day drinking. And I watched a local spelling bee that was being broadcast on television. And you know what the difference is between fifth graders spelling big words and Hillary Clinton announcing she's running for president?
What is the difference between Hillary Clinton?
A spelling bee is actually suspenseful. There's actually an element of surprise. Unlike the Clinton rollout, where it's literally the least surprising thing that has ever happened. I'm just so full of joy and happiness and just like this overwhelming sense of wellness that it is not my job to cover the Clinton rollout.
We clipped the video of Hillary like doing her first campaign stop in Iowa and reporters running as the Scooby van drove past. And a former person who used to be a Hillary reporter but now covers other stuff, by choice, by the way, G-chatted me and he was like, this is exactly why I don't want to do this, or I didn't want to do this, and I'm much happier now.
The Washington Free Beacon had a vine of that clip of reporters running after her with the Yaggity Yak music playing in the background. It's so funny. I watched it like 5 times this morning. It's really funny.
I told a source who I was talking to at the time when we posted this. I said, you know, there's no dignity in being a reporter. There's absolutely, completely, 100% none. And she said, yeah, I don't doubt that at all. A press person told me that. Yeah.
When flacks are telling you, you don't have
dignity. Yeah, when flacks are telling you there's no dignity.
Yikes.
Do you think this changes anything? I mean, you know, now that she's...
what does it mean?
I don't know. What is there to say about this, Betsy?
You know, I honestly think sort of usually... Here's what I think about this. Usually stories about how the media is covering something and what are reporters doing. Like, usually I think this stuff is navel-gazy and boring and not interesting and only of interest if you live in D.C. or New York and you are a media professional. However, in the case of Hillary, I think the media story is fascinating. I mean, just like watching these guys hustle across a field, you know, trying to sprint in their ill-fitting khakis after this like big lumbering ugly black van. It's just like, you know, I can honestly say I've never seen anything like that before. And maybe this is just because I haven't been covering politics for as long as most reporters have, but wow, that was amazing. Yeah. So I think watching like how every single thing Hillary Clinton does for the next year and a half is going to make news. I think that's interesting. I mean, the fact that there was a massive media story when she went to Chipotle, the fact that it was like, oh my God, drop everything. Hillary Clinton went to Chipotle.
Wearing front sunglasses. Page,
wearing sunglasses. Didn't introduce herself. What did she order? Crap. What did she order? Get somebody on that. Like, we are going to be listening to this and watching this and hearing stories about this for the next, how many months is it? Is it
16, 15, something like that. I think so.
For the next 16 months of our finite, precious time on Spaceship Earth. It's amazing! Like, anyway,
I don't even know what smart take is there to have about Hillary Clinton ordering Chipotle and wearing sunglasses. I think that's entirely normal.
I think it says more about the people of Iowa.
Do you think it's that normal they to didn't wear recognize Hillary?
Do you think it's normal to wear sunglasses in Chipotle, though?
Yes, I do, Betsy. I do. You know
where
what?
Are you from? You
know
why? That's not normal. That's bizarre.
It's a Midwest thing. You wouldn't know. Oh wait, you're from the Midwest.
I'm from the Midwest. I don't wear sunglasses inside. Midwesterners are humans. It's not like we're born in barns.
I don't know. It's a, you know, Iowa's a very sunny state. I don't know.
I don't even think this was in Iowa. I think this is like in Illinois. Look, the best explanation for why she wears sunglasses.
Maybe it's in Ohio. It was one of them.
I don't know. I haven't read enough of the deeply detailed reporting news stories on Hillary Clinton's
deep dive.
Deep dives. I think the only reason I can't believe we're talking about this. Okay, really quickly. I think the only reason Hillary I can't this is absurd. I think the only my hot take. I think the only reason Hillary I think the only reason Hillary Clinton would have worn sunglasses in a Chipotle is because she didn't want to be recognized, which is totally understandable because apparently when people recognize Hillary Clinton, they totally lose it. And
how do you not recognize, but I don't understand how you don't recognize her when there's like secrets.
A good question. Actually,
Betsy,
this is a good question.
We're not going to indulge anymore in this. Finish your thought. We're going to get on to substantive politics, okay?
Okay, so here's my last quick thought on Hillary Clinton. And this is actually a good segue to our next point. Is that between Slate and Daily Beast, I went out to Arizona to visit some friends of mine. And one of them is a teacher at a charter school out there, and she has a fifth grade class. And I talked to her fifth graders for a little bit about journalism and politics and the First Amendment and America, you know, my job. And what I found out from interfacing with these Arizona fifth graders from a very scientific straw poll is they knew who Hillary Clinton was. They knew who Jeb Bush was. They did not know who Scott Walker was. And they thought Ted Cruz was related to Tom Cruise. So, of the Arizona fifth graders, Hillary's in pretty good shape.
I wish he was. Speaking of Ted Cruz.
It's a fair question.
It is a fair question. Things have to be answered. It is not the dumbest question that's been asked.
It's true. It's not. Political reporting is not that hard. You're a smart, ambitious fifth grader with an appetite for news.
Go for it.
Give it a shot, kid.
I think wages are actually getting better in reporting right now, which is something for another day. But I was thinking about this
Never
morning.
Never mind,
so.
Fifth graders. Don't come for my job.
Yeah, wait. Stay away. Stay away. It's terrible here. That's my money hand side. Let's get on to substantive news, which you had. And Betsy, I'm just going to I'm gonna be totally honest here. You had an absolutely phenomenal story on Ted Cruz's sugar daddy. I swear it was open in my tabs for most of the days. I actually did read it twice. It was so good. I was really jealous. And I was jealous partially because it's been something that I had been talking with other people about, not reporting. Cruz isn't one of my candidates. But like, and we hit this in a previous episode with Eliana on Woodruff and Strauss. Like, the big question with Cruz was, where is his money going to come from? You found it. You found the guy. You explained who it was. Can you talk about that a little bit? This guy from Renaissance Tech?
Yeah. So, typically political presidential candidates have one super PAC. They kind of give the super PAC their thumbs up. The super PAC can take unlimited donations, make unlimited independent, non-coordinated ad buys supporting this candidate. Well, Cruz has, instead of having one super PAC, he has four. They're called Keep the Promise, Keep the Promise 1, Keep the Promise 2, Keep the Promise 3, which is totally weird. So when that news broke on I guess it was Wednesday morning, we were all kind of sitting around the office scratching our heads, like, why would he have these four identical super PACs? And then Eliana reported that each super PAC was tied to a different billionaire family, and that one billionaire family running one of those super PACs was Robert Mercer. So we thought, huh, who's Robert Mercer? So called some campaign attorneys, did some Googling, you know, sifted through stuff. And what we found is that Robert Mercer is, well, he's very reclusive, which we say reclusive, like if you have a lot of money, you have a responsibility to have a TV show. You know, he's not a super public figure. He's not a celebrity. You would not recognize him if you saw him walking down the street. I found one video of him giving a speech, and it was winning like a Lifetime Achievement Award for computer linguistics, and most of the speech was totally incomprehensible. Like, it was like tech stuff that I did not understand at all. But what's interesting about Robert Mercer is that he's the CEO, I believe, or co-founder, co-CEO of a hedge fund called Renaissance Technologies. And I'm not a finance person, so this is all me just, you know, re-reporting and sourcing other people's reporting on the finance side of it. But his hedge fund had found sort of a legal loophole so that they could pay the lower long-term tax rates for trades that essentially, for all practical purposes, were really short-term. And again, the tax law there is complicated. We explain it in the piece a little bit and link to other pieces where if you're interested in wonking out about it, you can. But sort of the big picture is, between the year 2001 and 2013, Renaissance Technologies, the hedge fund, paid $6 billion less in taxes than it theoretically should have. And the reason we know this is because the Senate Permanent Subcommittee for Investigations did a pretty significant high-profile investigation of this hedge fund last summer. And the hedge fund drew just like scathing bipartisan scrutiny. Carl Levin, the senator, the now retired senator from Michigan, chaired the committee. John McCain was on the committee. McCain just...
Someone once told me it's the SEAL Team 6 of investigative bodies.
Okay, yeah.
In Congress. Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's good to know. It's serious, right? It's not a partisan organization. It was right. Not a partisan investigation. And you know, McCain just excoriated these guys for the way that they'd found to kind of get around this. So what we just kind of looked at is, who is Robert Mercer? What are some things he said in the past? What are organizations he's supported? And then, you know, one reason this is interesting is because Cruz has made a pretty big deal out of going after, you know, the term is crony capitalism, basically collusion between federal regulators and big businesses to get big businesses carve-outs in the tax codes and legal loopholes and stuff, which is, I think most people agree, it's a pretty major problem. I think there's bipartisan right. consensus that this kind of collusion is bad and it shouldn't happen. But of course, the reason a lot of these policies don't change is that everyone is against big government collusion when it's their, you know, when it's companies that aren't donating to them, right? Republicans are really upset about it when it's companies that donate to Democrats. Democrats are really upset about it when it's companies that donate to Republicans.
What a coincidence. So, funny.
I don't know why. I don't know why that's what beats me. So, you know, the question does this reflect where Senator Cruz is on Wall Street regulation? Is it going to affect his positioning? Is it going to affect his posture? Look, it totally might not. It might not. It is completely plausible that a presidential candidate can take a lot of money from someone with whom he does not agree on all issues. This does not mean Cruz is a bad candidate. This doesn't mean you shouldn't vote for Cruz. This doesn't mean Cruz is doing anything wrong. All it means is, here's Robert Mercer, interesting person, interesting hedge fund, and just sort of a look at him.
And Cruz has raised $31 million, or he's reported raising $31 million so far.
Which is really impressive. That's a huge deal.
Yeah.
I gotta say, Betsy, of all the
rollouts, I am actually most impressed with Ted Cruz's. From shallow things, like, I kind of like the flame logo for him, the star and the flame
thing.
Yeah, I think the other ones are all kind of ugly, as most campaign logos are. I don't like Hillary's FedEx sign. But I'm continually impressed with everything from, you know, Cruz's decision on Liberty University in Virginia, where at first I was really confused about it, but now it makes sense. He had a bunch of screaming conservative young people around him cheering. when he was polling at like 4% or 5%. Mm-hmm. He's got a sugar daddy. He's got $31 million. I'm not really quite sure. I mean, I think you explained in the piece that the four super PACs allow different big backers to control this, and so they would be involved there.
Right.
He's got a team to get a little wonky. Jeff Rowe is his campaign manager, who is pretty well respected in Republican circles. A little, you know, kind of a little edgy, but definitely not sort of the fringy Tea Party world black market of operatives that I thought, and I think a lot of people thought, Cruz would look to. So far, I'm actually pretty impressed with Ted Cruz's rollout. And
you know what else is funny about his rollout, too, is that the news stories that kind of dominated coverage right after his rollout were Ted Cruz is not going to be able to raise money. The billionaire donor community does not like Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz, okay, wacko Tea Partiers might vote for him, but he won't be able to make any money. I mean, there's a Politico headline that was, Ted Cruz is way behind in fundraising. And there's lots of stories saying that. And in retrospect, it's really funny looking at that stuff, because then Cruz is kind of like, you know, drop the mic. $31 million, bitches, you know, what's up? Which, that's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money real fast.
Yep.
So I'm actually, you know.
And look, the fact that he's raised a lot of money means that could mean that any one donor is going to have less influence on his public policy positions.
Perhaps. Perhaps. I feel like there's a lot to know about Ted Cruz in as a candidate for president, actually. I don't know his positions on a lot of things. He's going to be pressed on things that he hasn't really had to before, and it's...
Oh no, you cut out. Are you there?
Questions about this shutdown and whether he hates Obamacare. You're still good.
Good. Can you just say that again? He's going to be pressed on some things.
He's going to be pressed on some things that are not related to the shutdown or how much he hates Obamacare. He's going to be pressed on, you know, I mean, not just like gay marriage and things where he can take the easy conservative position, but Social Security, which I want to talk about next with Chris Christie. Or, I don't know, I mean, religious freedom laws has been something he's been out in front of lately. But, you know, gun violence in inner cities or workplace, you know, pay equity. And it'll be really interesting because Heidi Cruz is not your average, you know, homemaker.
She's not a Stepford wife.
No, she's not a Stepford wife at all. She has had her own career. She has struggled as many, like, proactive would-be first ladies are. You know, she's always wanted to be involved in her own way. And have her own life and been in the finance and banking community. And she's a really interesting story.
I think you could argue she's been more successful in her field than Senator Cruz has in his, arguably.
Yeah,
at least up until Cruz became a senator. I mean,
yeah, I think you can say that for a lot of candidates and their wives. You know, from Ann Romney, Mary Kay Huntsman. I don't know. I think they've all been sort of like more on the family side, and Heidi Cruz has sort of balanced it all, which will be fascinating.
And their kids are quite young, too. Yeah. So she's had more time pre-children to be in the workforce and sort of be racking up these accomplishments and stuff.
So Cruz is going to be an interesting candidate to watch.
Okay.
We got to go in a second. I want to hit one more topic, which was Chris Christie, who I thought also had a pretty good, pretty deft sort of move yesterday of reminding everyone that he's still running for president, or he's going to. Until yesterday, I wasn't convinced. Where he went to New Hampshire, yeah, I wasn't. He hadn't been that active. He hadn't been raising, you know, that money. He hadn't been out there. But yesterday in New Hampshire, he went and laid out his plan for Social Security reform, and you know, sort of argued that there needs to be cuts to the program and means testing to entitlement programs to save the long term viability of it. And basically, one of the key points was, wants to raise the retirement eligibility age. He wants to, by 2 years, he also wants to start a sliding scale for Social Security benefits for income. So $80,000, you know, up to $80,000 in income, you get full benefits. After $80,000, it starts to go down. $200,000, you get no benefits. You know, I mean, Social Security, I think Social Security, but I'm consistently wrong, but Social Security might be one of the big topics of this campaign cycle, partially because, as TPM previously reported by my former colleague Dylan Scott, He's at National Journal now. I love Dylan.
That's me.
Yeah. You know, House Republicans made this rule change to try and leverage changes to Social Security. On the left, Democrats are pushing for expanding Social Security. Christie, I mean, he didn't exactly dominate the news cycle yesterday, but he reinserted himself by having this big speech and laying it out there in New Hampshire. It was very clear that he did this to get attention and to, you know, make a big Christie splash.
Sure. And can I ask you a question? Because you obviously have a much better grasp of sort of the progressive id than I do. Christie's basic, or one component of his proposal, you know, that if your income is high, you shouldn't get Social Security benefits, strikes me as kind of like a, you know, like a progressive tax code version of Social Security, right? This idea that, you know, from each as they are able to each as they need, to use very over-the-top rhetoric for this, right? So if you're a progressive or liberal defender of Social Security, and you're defending it because of its importance to the safety net, because of economic equality issues, you know, dyed in the wool from a socially liberal point of view, what is the argument for giving Social Security benefits to people who don't need them, like to people who are wealthy?
Right. So there was a really good piece at The Upshot a little while ago that sort of explained this. I think it was by, I'm pretty sure it was by Justin Wolfers. I'll make sure we link to it.
Okay.
Which basically argued that government programs, and especially entitlement programs, are poor if they're only for the poor. They only really work if everyone gets them. And the thing about Social Security and Social Security
reform, that's also like an argument for single payer and our
right,
and, right.
Exactly. It's, I mean, but you asked for the liberal.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the important thing to keep in mind, which my boss, Josh Marshall, also, I'm just dropping links and names all day, sorry, is that Democrats and Republicans have both championed Social Security reform and entitlement reform over the years. Going back to the 90s, not so much lately, but definitely during the Clinton era, it was something that came up. And, you know, I mean, that's the argument right now. Christie, in his speech, cited Jerry Brown in California, who by far is definitely a favorite of Democrats on, you know, similar programs or similar changes to this. So, but to go back to your question, I mean, that's the argument that okay. Everybody should get this. Everybody should benefit from this because you never know what's going to happen. Your income may go away. And the only way to make these programs work and to not make them targets of, you know, fiscal hawks who want to gut everything and think that, I don't know, I mean, that people are using their Social Security money to go on cruises or to buy steaks a la food stamps. And by the way, you can't use food stamps to like, I mean, some of the arguments on this in Missouri, I think, where you can't use your food stamps to buy a movie ticket or something. And the philosophy on the left is that this is because food stamps is a program that is specifically for the poor. It is not for everyone. And that's why it's being demonized by fiscal hawks like that.
So the idea would be guaranteed minimum income then? Would that be a preferable way of approaching entitlements from the left?
I think they
instead of food stamps, like, I mean, does that mean food stamps for everyone?
No, like, I mean, I think food stamps and Social Security are two different programs.
That is true.
So
correct,
right?
To see if you're all the way awake this morning, Daniel. I don't know. I'm just curious, like, what the parallel would be in the food stamp program to
right. I don't
Social
think
Security.
There is a parallel. I don't think there is a direct ancillary.
I feel like the ancillary would be like a guaranteed minimum income.
Right. Yeah, and that's right. Never going to happen. Never. Okay, I can promise you that. So that's the philosophy for it. It's definitely becoming a litmus test, I think, on the left. You have progressive groups and candidates arguing for this. Martin O'Malley, I think, is going to be the big one championing it. Others sort of like, you're starting to see right now sort of the pressure point coalition that's going to try and move Hillary on this and on issues like this. So
I like pressure point coalition. That's a good term.
I'm trying to.
Did
I'm
you
trying
make
to,
up that term? That's a good term.
I did make up that
That's
term.
So, that's good. I like that.
Bill de Blasio, who got a lot of attention for not endorsing Hillary right off the bat, which I think is kind of dumb.
It's amazing that not immediately.
Well, she wasn't even a candidate.
Not immediately genuflecting is controversial.
Amazing. Yeah, but, you know, the news cycle picked it up
the
because
next 16
her
months
campaign
are
going to
be so fun,
her.
Daniel. They're going to be what? So. The next 16 months are going to be so fun. Just kidding. I'm going to jump in front of a bus.
Yeah, so I think that's, I mean, that's the philosophy here. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens on the right on this, because, you know, especially for candidates like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, and Rubio's running for president now, we should say that.
We can say that, yeah.
Come from a state, who hail from states where there are a lot of old people who don't want their Social Security to go away, and a lot of wealthy old people who like their Social Security.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just going to be a fascinating thing, and I don't think it's going to, like, lay down by party lines. I think, you know, again, going back to Cruz, I think Cruz is in some ways kind of similar to Newt Gingrich, where he wants, he you know, is more than happy to get the spotlight when he makes pronouncements, but he's smarter about this.
Yeah.
So
he's not going to say dopey stuff. Like,
he's not going to say dopey things, and, you know, I think Cruz also needs another sort of bipartisan point. His big claim to fame is working with Kirsten Gillibrand on a sexual assault bill, which is great and really smart, I think. But, you know, he'll need more of those claims for
it to be... Well, you know what else is interesting about him is he's also been working on the criminal justice reform stuff, too.
Ah, yeah.
Rand Paul's gotten a lot more attention for it, but Cruz has been involved pretty much from day one. Cruz has some libertarian-ish instincts, not on foreign policy, but on constitutional issues. And I think, you know, this is something I should probably write about. I think people underestimate the extent to which his background as a constitutional lawyer impacts his approach to public policymaking.
Yeah.
And I think the criminal justice stuff, like, you know, he hasn't been as, you know, as shouty from the rooftops about it as Rand Paul has, but he's been an influential Republican working on it. So... look, good policy should be good politics, right?
I pray to God, Betsy, and we got to close out now, but I pray to God that this election cycle is not as bad as we think it's going to be. Because I don't know if you remember this, but in 2012, I talked to a lot of campaign reporters who were like, this is an unusually bad, terrible one. And now they're like, this one is going to be worse. Granted, reporters generally are not the most cheerful folks around, but... you know. Anyway.
You know. But you know.
But we're going to be doing this, you know, through the 2016 cycle.
Buckle up.
So, you know, that's it. Well, Betsy, congratulations on your new job. Please stop writing such brilliant pieces because they make me feel bad. Because, like, I mean, really, and bravo again on this thing because I thought it was a really well done piece.
Thank you.
So, I think we're hanging out this weekend, Friday. We're like, you know, cooking or something?
Maybe something like that.
Yeah.
Hanging out, having a social life. Who knows?
All right. Well, I will talk to you later.
Sounds good.
All right. Bye. All right.